at this time. And the federal court was held in the old customs house that stands on the corner of Bull and Bay Street. And the federal judge who presided was a member of the Supreme Court, Judge Wayne, who lived in the house that is now called the Juliet Lowe House. But before the Gordon family lived in the house, it was the home of Judge Wayne, who went from Savannah to the Supreme Court of the United States in Washington. Well, at that time, the Supreme Court judges would come all over the country and preside at cases. And he presided in the old custom house over the trial regarding the Wanderer, the last slave ship to be brought to this country. But this whole area is extremely colorful and beautiful. And it is regrettable that we have always been attracted, too many people have been ashamed of the fact that they came from the lanes and the unpaved streets, or from the country into the city. But in the old days, in this area, there were quite a few blacks who lived in the confines of the city. But there were many, particular after freedom, who bought cheap land, and many of them were allowed to buy small portions of the land of their former owners because in many cases their owners had run away when Sherman came. And as a result, all of Beaufort, you see, was literally a black community. And you got to Beaufort by way of a boat that came each day back and forth. And interestingly, at the turn of the century, there were two boats owned by Negroes in Beaufort that were large enough to have as many as a six-man crew. And it would come each day to Savannah either for our produce or to bring things into the city. One of these boats was owned by the father of Nathaniel Jenkins, who lives down on 37th Street near the cemetery. His daddy was called Goodness Jenkins because he was a man who had not only a restaurant, but many other things in the community, including the sale of the inebriating beverages of the area and what have you. And he had quite a bit of means, property, and what have you. And whenever he found one of his people in need of something, they know that they could, that Mr. Jenkins would befriend them. And he became known in the community as Goodness Jenkins. Another boat was owned by the father of Mr. William Austin, who used to be head waiter at one of the hotels here. His father had a boat that came from Beaufort to Savannah. All of these people are out of the Beaufort area. But at the turn of the century in Beaufort, the postmaster was a black man, the chief of police was black, the collector of customs was black. Every federal position that you could possibly think of in the Beaufort area was occupied by a black person just some 70 years or so ago. A good friend of mine passed in Beaufort, I think last week, the only Negro lawyer in Beaufort, Charles Washington, who I knew very, very well. We were active together in our student days in the NAACP. He was a classmate, by the way, of Martin Luther King at Morehouse. And we used to call King in those days Mike. It was ML, not Martin Luther, as people now say. And they were classmates. But Washington came from a fairly distinguished Beaufort family because his father before him was a lawyer in Beaufort. And his grandfather before him was a lawyer in Beaufort. His grandfather was J.I. Washington, Julius I. Washington, but commonly known among all the people as J.I. Interestingly enough, they practiced in that day and time, and I guess this is why I continue to hold on to W.W. as initials. The practice among our people in the olden days was to use initials in many cases because they could not spell, I imagine, too well. So they simplified the name as much as they could. Not only that, as you well know, they went to the Bible for many of their names, and of course they could spell it because it was spelled correctly in the Bible. But at other times, if they had many children and the father wasn't too religious, he would just many times take initials. When I was a boy, I had many friends who were named J.T., W.T., and there was no name other than J.T. or J.B., and that was the name, just the initials, J.B. And Beaufort was this kind of community, and during the time that J.I. Washington was a lawyer there, there weren't but two lawyers in Beaufort, one white and one black. And Mr. Washington, I understand, had white clients in that day as well as black clients. There are some other interesting stories regarding particular young Washington's father, but Mr. Washington became, J.I. became quite a man of influence, real estate holdings and what have you in the Beaufort area. Well, the same thing was true about Savannah. I am greatly disheartened when I look and I see our young people in particular losing sight of where power really lies and wasting away their time in school and not making good use of opportunities. I think of this community 40, 50, or even 60 years ago, while now we have just five black doctors, seven at the most. When I was a boy even, 40 to 50 years ago, there were 20-some-odd black doctors in Savannah. 20-some, I think, by actual count. At one time, I counted 23. And here we're now down to no more than seven, and about the same number of dentists. I knew the time when there were doctors and dentists scattered all over this community in every hamlet and section where black people live. But interestingly enough, this was a tremendously important black metropolis at the rise of our country, and many of the great and distinguished people, families came out of either Savannah, the Beaufort, or St. Simon. For example, you well know that the present day Jim Brown, football and movie star great, well, he's out of St. Simon, outside of Brumsey. Well, before Jim Brown came from St. Simon, we had Robert Abbott, who in his lifetime operated the largest black paper in this country, the Chicago Defendant. But Abbott grew up in Savannah as a boy. His mother, at a very young age, brought him from St. Simon to Savannah. This was the big city. This was the big city for everybody in this area. And they lived in the area just before you get to the Tompkins School on Bay Street. That's where the homestead of the Abbotts exist. And his father was pastor. His mother must have married again because the name Sinstack enters. This was a German name, by the way. And we knew of a German merchant on Bay Street by the name of Sinstack. Well, for some reason, it appears that Robert Abbott's family got mixed up in there, and his father was Reverend Sinstack, who was the pastor of the Congregational Church located at Habersham and Taylor Street. And he operated, his father before him operated a little newspaper in the Woodville section. And by the way, that's Woodville, not Woodsville. It was called the Woodville area. And his father operated a newspaper out there. The press, by the way, is still in the Woodville community. Some years later, when they tore down the old Abbott Sinstack homestead, and it's sad that we destroy our monument, but the house was torn down, and the printing press that was in the garage or in the outhouse or something there was dragged down the road to Mr. McKay, Ransom McKay, who is a cousin of the Sinstacks. It was dragged down to his house, and I believe that Mr. Ransom McKay still has that old printing press. I guess in some way we ought to make certain that the Sinstacks, or we, preserve it as being the first press that Robert Abbott, who became the great newspaper tycoon, worked on. It's there in the garage at the Ransom McKay's house. But this was our community, and I would think I need to work into our discussion something about early efforts at education, because I am fascinated by the fact that we do not realize how much our people were thirsty for an education. Negroes learned to read and to write, and they were taught in clandestine ways to read and write long before freedom. For example, there is some record of a white man conducting a school before freedom for Negroes in the Yamacraw area on Bay Street. And there was also an effort on the part of James Sims, who wrote the history of the First Colored Baptist Church in North America, and who distinguished, oh my goodness, James Sims, we're told, was city judge in this town during the Reconstruction period, black man, who was either the great-grandfather or the great-great-grandfather of Merle Sims, who heads the Shadco program. But we're not too proud. But that same Sims was one of the two first black representatives to represent Chatham County in the state legislature. Mr. Sims, who was a preacher as well, and one of the more literate and free, he was free, and one of the more literate Negroes of our community, became depressed before freedom about the various restrictions that we even placed on him as a free black in this area. And so he left this community. I believe he was whipped for trying to teach Negroes to read and write in a school that he conducted somewhere around Barron Street. And he left the community after being whipped and beaten and harassed by the whites, because they felt as though that he was dispensing unlawfully information to the other blacks. And it was true that he was trying to teach his people to read and write. He went to Boston. And while in Boston, he came in contact with a black man who was free, a mulatto by the name of Prince Hall, who had served, I believed, either in the American Revolution or under British officers. He must have served under British officers, because while serving under the British officers, they made him a Freemason. And Prince Hall, therefore, became the first black man in America to be a Mason. And he was made a Mason by the British troops who had been made Masons in England. And Prince Hall then went about setting up black Masons after the British troops made him a Mason. And James Sims, while in Boston, came under this influence and became a Mason. And when freedom came, Sims immediately came back to Savannah and he set up three lodges in Savannah, and then he, Eureka number one, Pythagoras, and the other name don't come to, escapes me at the moment. But he also sent up Banneker Lodge, I believe number two, in Augusta. And these four lodges became the Grand Lodge of Georgia, met in Savannah and formed the Grand Lodge of Georgia. And James Sims, therefore, became the first Grand Master of black Masons or Negro Masons in Georgia. But he was quite a leader. So there you see, I have talked about him as being the man who, before freedom, tried to conduct a school here, as being the man who started Masonry in this community, as being the one of the two first black representatives to go to Atlanta, elected to go to Atlanta during the Reconstruction period from this area. And he likewise wrote the first history of the oldest Negro church in North America. But there was one other thing that Sims did, and how he did it, I don't not quite know. We find that around the 1880s and before, he was publishing books. He published. And one of the persons that he was publisher for was William Ward Brown, William Wells Brown, who was the first black man in America to make a living off his writings. Now, there had been other writers up until that time, but they did other things as well as write. Many of them had to preach for a living. Some of the others had to be carpenters or to teach school or something else. But William Wells Brown was the first black man in our country to make a living off his writings, to be professionally a writer and nothing else. And one of his books I have in my possession was published by Sims Printing or Press at that time. In talking about the early struggles for an education, it is likewise interesting that 1964, when the schools were integrated as a result of NAACP winning a suit in the Court of Appeals in Atlanta, in this district, Negro children on the high school level were integrated. But this was not the first integration of schools in our community. When the Union troops came to Savannah, and Savannah was under siege, Negroes went to school in what is now the Massey School, located at Gordon and Abercorn. Negroes went to school there in what is, I think, sometime called now the oldest school building still standing in Georgia. But we went to school there, so that some 763, somewhere about 69, when Negro children, 68 or 69, when Negro children began to attend Massey School. This was not the first time that Negro children had sat at desks and had been instructed to read and write in that particular school. Other efforts to teach Negroes to read and write before freedom existed at various points. One was that on Price Street, to the rear of the Second Baptist Church, old Reverend DeVoe was pastor of the Second Baptist Church, and he lived across Price Street in a house that Mills Lane bought just recently and moved to another site. This was a black man's home that white folk are now living in. And he was the pastor of Second Baptist Church, and his daughters, they were mulattoes, fair complexion people. The DeVoes, you could hardly tell them from white. And his daughters went away to school, and I believe must have even went to Europe to study. But she came back, and they were free. And she conducted a school, tried to conduct a school in her home, in their home. And this was one of those houses where they had the disappearing stairs in the kitchen. And when the inspectors would come around to check to make certain no school was going on, since it was unlawful to teach a black man to read and write, they would march the children up the disappearing stairs. They pulled the stairs down and marched children up in the attic of the house and have them lay down and remain quiet. And they would push the stairs back up until the inspectors had gone. Then the children would take their slates and their books and come back down, and they would continue school in the kitchen. Another one of the schools that we have a very definite record of is the school that a Mrs. Woodhouse conducted in Bay Lane between Habersham and Price Street back in 1848. Susie King Taylor talks of having gone to school there. And Mrs. Taylor became a woman of unusual distinction, because when the Civil War came, she was still a young woman, because you could understand that in 1848 she was a girl going to school in Bay Lane on the east side. So about 63, you see, that we would say that she probably was in her 20s. But she became a nurse to the Union soldiers, and in later years, an educator. But she was quite a distinguished person. And she wrote her memoirs, or her reminiscences of what life was being a black woman in America. And this book ought to be reprinted, because it's a very vivid and beautiful account of what life was like and how people struggled in order to achieve. The other thing that I'd like to talk about, just briefly, is that while Negroes did not have schooling on a mass scale until freedom, and this is tremendously important, I'm wondering if you realize what it was like to be a slave when Massa Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. Here are people who, by and large, had never been taught to read or to write or to be given any kind of information, and who were suddenly turned loose into a strange world and made to go for themselves, when not having given any preparation or anything for this new experience. Not able to count or to figure, to write, to read, or to do anything. This is the plight of our people. And as a result, the federal government established what they call the Freedmen's Bureau. And they established schools throughout the South. And interestingly enough, in those first schools, you found old men and women, 80 and 90 years of age, as well as women with the children in their arms, as well as the young 6, 7, all in the same classroom. 8 to 80, we would say, were there, all trying to fathom out the mysteries of the alphabet and to learn to read and write. And they weren't too proud for a grandparent to sit with his great-grandchildren in the same classroom to learn. And I think that this is terrific and powerful, Because there are many of my people today who likewise do not have the ability to read and to write, but they are too proud and ashamed to go into a school and to let people know that they can't and that they want to learn to read and write. There are doubt classes and we pass them up. I work with church people and I know that there are men sitting on deacon boards, you see, who can't read and can't write. One of the most pathetic situations, I stood in a bank line, and here was a black man who had earned his money and had a pretty substantial bank account in the bank. And he went there, and it was necessary in his account for him to write. He was making a deposit, and making a deposit or a withdrawal. And the lady passed to him the form that he was to sign. And he say, "I can't write," and I heard her in a loud voice say, "You can't write?" And here was this big man who was man enough to command his trade and earn his money, but becoming completely disarmed and trembling and with a weak voice, "No, ma'am, I can't write." And very frankly, there was no excuse for it, because just as he learned to count his money, and he could count, because when she handed him that money, he counted every penny. Just as he learned to count, he could have learned to write and to read. And this is the kind of thing that we must see and don't see, that the motivation must be there, because being able to read and write is black power, if that's what you want, you see. But this is the power, because in that way, when somebody gives you the will or the insurance policy or the deeds to your property or what have you, you can read the fine print and understand what it is that you are buying. There are people, because they could not figure and because they were poor, are holding insurance companies, mainly in white insurances, where they have been paying 15 and 20 cents a week for 40 and 50 years. And whenever they die, they ain't gonna get but $100. And very frankly, that kind of money, properly invested by them, would not be worth $100, but possibly $1,000 on the market now. This is the kind of thing, but it was all because they could not read and write. Well, now we could excuse it 40 and 50 years ago, but there is no excuse for it now. But we can say what we want, but there are boys and girls who are bopping and whopping and who are being expelled and playing hooky and leaving school at the slightest provocation, are missing the bus and not going and playing all day, are going to school, very frankly, to play football and basketball, who are going to come out almost in the same predicament as their fathers and mothers and grandparents were 40 and 50 and 100 years ago, and even at freedom, not being able to fathom the mysteries of reading and writing.
Mr. Law, you have been involved with the different facets of the movement and things of this nature. How can we motivate, or how can you, or how can we, I put you and I in the same boat, to motivate the youth to take your footsteps, my footsteps, Mr. Adams' footsteps, and on down the line to move on and on?
One of the things is that history, and don't fool yourself, I'm talking about history, a study about the activities of black people, white people, red people, all people. A knowledge of history is of a paramount importance. Yet, many of us are of the opinion that this is a subject that ain't too important. It don't help you make a living, you see. But it enables you to think and to assess a situation, to profit by the experiences of the past. And one of the things that we as a people need to begin to pay close attention to is that we are going through a period in the 1970s that is closely akin to the period of the 1870s, when the Negro came into his first freedom, that there is very little difference. But we, and keep in mind, there were no Jim Crow laws, you know, in 1870. There are people still alive today who could tell you that they knew way back yonder when Negroes sat anywhere on the streetcars that they wanted to sit, you see. And that they went into this place and that Negroes and whites bishoped in some of the same churches and this kind of thing. In many of those early churches, I must confess, Negroes were in the balcony and the white folk were on the main floor. But the white folk were in the front and the Negroes in the rear. But they sat anywhere they want to on the streetcars. And one of the reasons for it was because they had the white folk children. And it would have been pretty ironic for them to take the white folk children back in the colored section. So when they had the white folk children, there's no question about where they sat, you see. They sat with the white folk. But there were no Jim Crow laws in fact, though, until the turn of the century. And this is when the separate, the colored and the white signs began to appear. It was at the turn of the century when these things occurred. Some 70 years or so ago, but prior to, from freedom until the turn of the century, Negroes had free movement, you see. There were office holders in Savannah. Colonel DeVoe, who was the publisher of the Tribune, was the collector of customs for the port of Savannah. In that big gray building that you see sitting in front of City Hall, and he had his black staff, Walter Scott's brother, worked for him. And he had his staff there. I must confess, most of them were mulattoes, and you could hardly tell them from white folk. But they were colored very definitely. And they ran the custom house. Colonel DeVoe was likewise the commander of the black militia, of the state militia of that day, which is similar to the National Guard and this kind of thing. He was the colonel in charge of that military unit. And we had positions of importance. Interestingly enough, instead of West Broad Street, the main business section for Negroes at the turn of the century was at in the area around Bull and State Street. All down State Street side, the federal building there, were Negro lawyers upstairs and in the buildings there. One man operated a bank in one corner of his store all along in that section. All down the area where Atlantic Savings is now, Negroes were in business all along there. In fact, the Tribune was published at the corner of the first street would be, St. Julian. It was on the corner of St. Julian and Barnard. That's where the Tribune was published in that day and time. The Negro Masonic Lodge used to meet around on Bay Street at one time, and I think another time on the near Bull, at a hall near Bull and Congress, somewhere in there. And a little later on, at Broughton and Jefferson, along in there. He was publishing books. He published. And one of the persons that he was publisher for was William Ward Brown, William Wells Brown, who was the first black man in America to make a living off his writings. Now, there had been other writers up until that time, but they did other things as well as write. Many of them had to preach for a living. Some of the others had to be carpenters or to teach school or something else. But William Wells Brown was the first black man in our country to make a living off his writings, to do and to be professionally a writer and nothing else. And one of his books I have in my possession was published by Sims Printing, our press, at that time. In talking about the early struggles for an education, it is likewise interesting that 1964, when the schools were integrated as a result of NAACP winning a suit in the Court of Appeals in Atlanta, in this district, Negro children on the high school level were integrated. But this was not the first integration of schools in our community. When the Union troops came to Savannah, and Savannah was under siege, Negroes went to school in what is now the Massey School, located at Gordon and Abercorn. Negroes went to school there in what is, I think, sometime called now the oldest school building still standing in Georgia. But we went to school there, so that in some 763, somewhere about 69, when Negro children, 68 or 69, when Negro children began to attend Massey School, this was not the first time that Negro children had sat at desks and had been instructed to read and write in that particular school. Other efforts to teach Negroes to read and write before freedom existed at various points. One was at on Price Street, to the rear of the Second Baptist Church. Old Reverend DeVoe was pastor of the Second Baptist Church, and he lived across Price Street in a house that Mills Lane bought just recently and moved to another site. This was a black man's home that white folk are now living in. And he was the pastor of Second Baptist Church, and his daughters, they were mulattoes, fair complexion people. The DeVos, you could hardly tell them from white. And his daughters went away to school, and I believe must have even went to Europe to study. But she came back, and they were free. And she conducted a school, tried to conduct a school in her home, in their home. And this was one of those houses where they had the disappearing stairs in the kitchen. And when the inspectors would come around to check to make certain no school was going on, since it was unlawful to teach a black man to read and write, they would march the children up the disappearing stairs. They pulled the stairs down and marched children up in the attic of the house and have them lay down and remain quiet. And they would push the stairs back up until the inspectors had gone. Then the children would take their slates and their books and come back down, and they would continue school in the kitchen. Another one of the schools that we have a very definite record of is the school that a Mrs. Woodhouse conducted in Bay Lane between Habersham and Price Street back in 1848. Susie King Taylor talks of having gone to school there, and Mrs. Taylor became a woman of unusual distinction, because when the Civil War came, she was still a young woman, because you could understand that in 1848 she was a girl going to school in Bay Lane on the east side. So about 63, you see, that we would say that she probably was in her 20s. But she became a nurse to the Union soldiers, and in later years an educator. But she was quite a distinguished person. And she wrote her memoirs or her reminiscences of what life was being a black woman in America. And this book ought to be reprinted because it's a very vivid and beautiful account of what life was like and how people struggled in order to achieve. The other thing that I'd like to talk about, just briefly, is that while Negroes did not have schooling on a mass scale until freedom, and this is tremendously important, I'm wondering if you realize what it was like to be a slave when Massa Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. Here are people who, by and large, had never been taught to read or to write or to be given any kind of information, and who were suddenly turned loose into a strange world and made to go for themselves with not having given any preparation or anything for this new experience. Not able to count or to figure, to write, to read, or to do anything. This is the plight of our people. And as a result, the federal government established what they call the Freedmen's Bureau. And they established schools throughout the South. And interestingly enough, in those first schools, you found old men and women, 80 and 90 years of age, as well as women with the children in their arms, as well as the young 6, 7, all in the same classroom.